Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention? And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
This is Radio Influence. The future is now.
You are in the trenches with former Buccaneers offensive lineman Ian Beckles on Radio Influence.
Hello, everybody. This is Ian Beckles, and welcome back to In the Trenches. Before we get this show started, let's show love to our title sponsor, Hess Spinal Centers. They provide the best medical care for you and your family when you're going through this tough time after a car accident. If you need treatment, if you need knowledge, anything to do with these car accidents, you want to go to Hess Spinal Centers. They have 16 locations in the Bay Area. 1-800-618-HESS. Don't stress. Call Hess. 1-800-618-HESS. Hess. Now, this is going to be a special show, not because of me, but because of my special guest, who is Mr. Chris Landry, who has his own podcast, the Chris Landry Football Podcast. Mr. Chris Landry, how are you today, brother?
Ian, I'm doing well. It's great to be with you. Great to catch up with you again and talk football.
Now, I'm going to say this, and I'm not somebody who blows smoke. I just don't do it. I don't like it. I'm a fan because I've listened to you when you were on 620, I think on the Big Dog Show and some other shows, and you're one of the few people out there that when you speak, you sound like you know what you're talking about.
Well, that's very kind of you. I appreciate it, and I guess, you know, and I think you can relate to this as a player. It just comes natural, I think. Just you call upon your experiences and it's been, gosh, almost 30 years now as a coach and as a scout at the college and NFL level. You just try to maybe provide something to the fan that is maybe a little different from a firsthand experience. So hopefully they enjoy it as much as you do. I really appreciate the kind words. It means a lot.
So you have been a scout on the college level and the NFL level as well?
Yeah, a college coach, recruiting coordinator, worked for Belichick and ran scouting departments for years and years, still do consulting work for teams. So coaching and scouting for 30 plus years is what I've been involved in and what I do continue to do on a daily basis.
Now, you know, you said you scouted me way back when. What do you remember me as a player, whether it's coming out of college, coming out of pros? Did I underachieve? Did I overachieve? Did you think I would be a good football player, or was I a good football player? I don't know.
No, I thought you were a good football player, and I thought you would be good. Quite frankly, I thought that you were a guy that got a lot out of your ability. I thought that you were someone that really did a good job of maximizing your skills. I thought you played, as a lot of guards do, you play with a sense of instincts and ability to be able to use good technique. So I always was a fan of yours. I old school wise, what I always like as a coach is a guy that can get the most out of his ability. And, you know, you were a guy, I'm sure, I know I don't need to introduce this to your listeners, but a guy that maybe didn't come out from the what I would call the Johnny five-star list of prospects, you know, off the beaten path a little bit up north, as we like to call it, and you kind of earn your way. You earn your way in college and just got better and better. And, you know, if I would have guessed going in, I thought this guy's going to be a really good player, maybe play, in the league and be a suitable player and possible starter. But quite frankly, if I had to honestly say it, you even overachieved what I thought you might do. And I can remember that I thought Ed would have been like a fourth round grade on you, fourth to fifth round grade, which if I can remember, you were a fifth pick.
Correct. And you broke it down. I mean, I wouldn't say anything much different than that. Saying I overachieved basically is a way of saying I was really short, okay?
There are guys with more ability,
okay,
natural ability, that didn't play in the league as well or as long as you did.
Okay, I'm okay with that. But I actually had scouts come out of a room. I remember the scouts for the Raiders came out of the room and he said, "Man, if you were 6'5", you'd be a first round pick." And I go, "Well, I'm only 6'2". He goes, "First of all, you're only 6'1", and that's why you could be a middle round pick." And that's what happened.
Yeah. And listen, maybe you had more natural ability, maybe you would have, been even better. I don't know. We never know that. But the reality is never underestimate the person's ability. So much is how you project to the next level. And how well a guy plays in college is extremely important. I think it's the most important thing. However, it's how well you're doing is relative to who you're doing it against, and we're trying to project. And I think you surprised a lot of people in the league. I think that you proved a lot of people that maybe thought that had some questions about you. You overcame those.
Well, I mean, guys like Mel Kiper said I was camp meat, so I'm not a huge Mel Kiper fan. Now, through all your years of evaluating talent, when you're watching these kids come out of college and they're taking that next big step into the NFL, out of all the years of evaluation, people still make mistakes with the first pick of the NFL draft. Now, from your knowledge, if you had to write a list of importance that, these college players need to succeed when they get along to the next level, can you write a list, or is it different for every single athlete?
No, I think there's some things that are consistent. I think that there's certain things by position that will determine, but the physical parts are equal. It's like, the height, weight, and speed. Well, there's an ideal, size, speed. The tangibles, there's definitely an ideal. However, there are always exceptions. And to me, it comes down to a couple of things that I just come to all the time. What is a player's capacity to learn? Excuse me. And what is his willingness to learn? And in essence, how smart is he? I don't care what he knows. I want to know what's his ability to learn. And then does he like it enough? Because I don't care what it is. We can all relate to this. In school, there's some subjects we were just better at just because they were more interesting and we liked them. And, and some just, we just didn't like it. You gotta like football. I think if you like football, if you love football, you want to learn a lot about it. Listen, I was that way. I wasn't an elite player, and I had to do little things, and it spurred my initiation into coaching, be around it, and in, scouting. If you've got a guy that has the physical attributes and he can learn and he's willing to learn, it's your job as an organization to put good teachers around him and to utilize them. That's what I know and that's what I believe. I see too many guys that have a lot of natural ability, and I hear this a lot. Well, if he can do it, he should be able to do it more consistently. Yes, you need to teach him to do it more consistently. But what is their desire to do it? Because, oftentimes – when guys get into the league, they feel they've made it. Well, you didn't make it. You've been given a chance. And, whether you make it is when you sit back when you're done with your career and say, you know what? I spent, X amount of years. And, that's when you can look back. When you get into the league, you haven't done anything, whether you're the first pick or whether you're the 250th pick. You've given a chance. And you certainly are going to be given more of a chance the higher pick you are, because they've put more into you. They think more of, or they wouldn't have taken you as high. But at the end of the day, to me, what I see a guy failing, I see it's maybe his unwillingness to compete at the highest level like he should relative to others, or you have other factors that maybe are beyond the control, and that's, the body just doesn't hold up, the health doesn't hold up. Or I see a lot of players get ruined because they're not developed very well, and that's why oftentimes – players in their second, third stops really hit and become much better players than they were early. You never stay the same as a player, as a coach. Every day, you either get better or you get worse. So to me, that is the whole key, is what are the guys that are going to want to get better every day? And that's the guys that I want. Now, I want them, and I like to get them in that range that I know they're going to be really good. I don't care how tough a guy is and how smart he is. If he's 6 feet and he's 245 pounds, He's not going to play center in the league because he's just going to get overmatched. Mm-hmm. He's going to be 100 pounds. You can try hard all you want. That's not going to be good enough. But you can look at a guy and say, you know what, this guy is lacking here, there. But the other critical factors, he can overcome it, and there are some exceptions. You don't want to have a lot of exceptions, but some exceptions.
Sure, there's a lot of exceptions in everything, and I agree. First of all, there's a lot of exceptions in size, okay? Mark Stepnowski had no business being as good as he was, nor did Randall McDaniel, but they were both freaks of nature. Yes. And when you talk about loving the game, you know I love the game of football. Nobody has to tell me that. It's been that way since I was six. You know, but guys fall through the cracks. Like our first rounder, which would have been maybe my fourth year, was Charles McCray, who didn't pan out. Yeah. He didn't pan out. He's 6'7", 310. Then I ask him a question about football, and he says to me, I don't really watch football. And he didn't know whether we were in the NFC or the AFC. Now, how does that guy fall through the cracks? Because that guy can't succeed if you don't love the game. I mean, he didn't even like the game. How does he fall through the cracks?
Well, listen, I think that's just bad evaluating. I mean, that's a bad research on the player. The answer is pure simple that, hey, boy, the guy's a player. And you come out of Tennessee, big time player and athlete and all that, whatever. Well, that's fine, but, you know, you really trust him to be that type of player that's going to be committed to it. You mentioned Mark Stepnowski. I had Mark in Houston. We signed him, and as you mentioned, this guy was a bright player. And you teach him anything. So, yeah, I always put a lot in emphasis on what a guy is and how competitive he is and how prideful he is in football. And somebody that maybe – you know, okay, if they're not crazy about watching football, you may spend time with the family, that's fine. But they better love watching film. They better love getting better. They better love their craft, because if they don't, that size and speed will only get you so far.
No doubt, no doubt. Now, I've been around a lot of coaches, a lot, good, bad, and different. I didn't really know if they were good or bad till really after the fact, where I could evaluate them. How important is coaching? I'm going to give you a good example. Somebody like a Vinny Testaverde came into the league, first pick overall in the draft, and Ray Perkins was his offensive coordinator. Now, Ray wasn't really good with people. I don't think Ray was very good with X's and O's. So how important is it that you come into the league and have the right teacher? Because I think if Vinny Testaverde comes into the league and Bill Walsh is his teacher, I think it starts off differently. I'm not sure he doesn't go to the Hall of Fame.
Well, it's critically important. And in fact, I counter that question when people say things every year this time. Well, which one of these quarterbacks are going to be the best? And I always say, I can evaluate the quarterback. Quarterback, the physical, tangibles and the intangibles, you're trained enough and you do a good enough job, you can evaluate the quarterbacks. What I can't tell you is who's going to coach them. You know, who's going to be coaching them 3 years from now? Tell me the quarterback that's going to have the same coordinator for 3 and 4 years, and that guy is likely going to have a better career than the guy that maybe is a little bit better that goes to a situation, well, like Cleveland, where they've got coordinators every other year. Well, that's like being a rookie, you know, five times. You have to go start over again and again. So I think your coaching and how you raise guys in the league at any position, but certainly at the quarterback position, they've got the most to know and understand. That is critically important. And stability within that is important. This is why organizations win. You win as an organization and you lose as an organization. There's all those coaches that have been in Cleveland are not bad. You know, you mentioned the Bucks. I love them, but you know, when Mr. Culverhouse was there, and you know, there are a lot of things. He wasn't real good. You know, stability and kind of, you know, Tony and that group. I mean, the stability created. They were able to build something. Well, when you're building something, you can continue to grow and build upon it. When you're building it and you're knocking it down in 2 years, and you're building it again, and you're knocking it down, well, you're never arriving. You can never move into the house. You're constantly redoing it. I think that is so important. And then add to that is how well you're able to put talent around that player. I mean, you can coach a player well, but you got to put teammates around him. You got, you know, let's take the quarterback. You got to be able to have a good offensive line. You got to have a good running game to augment so that they're not teeing off on you. You've got to have good pass protection. You got to have good weapons that can make plays when you throw them the football. Then you got to have a good defense. And pretend, as you know, Ian, segment offense and defense. Well, offense and defense are connected because how you play offense is how you play defense. I mean, guess what? If you say, well, they don't have much of a running game. Well, the defense is awful. You're trailing every game. In this league, you can't stay committed to the running game if you're down 13, 17 points. So it's your defense, you know, keep you in games. Can you stay committed to the offense? And can you have good balance around the quarterback? And obviously the same things around you. If you know, good offensive lineman, you know, you got to have good play behind. You got to have good play. Dallas has been a recent example of a team that's had a really good offensive line. They've had a really good back. When healthy, they've been a really good team. And quite frankly, it's covered up some of the real holes they have on defense. So I think how you play on one side affects the other. So coaching is extremely important. And with that, putting a good team around players, that's what it's about. It's building blocks. And you know this, you can take a player in baseball and you can take a really good hitter, plug him in the fifth hole, and he may be a big hit for you. You can take a basketball player and put in one player makes a big difference. But in football, you know, he's got to fit. You know, or you sign a guard. Well, are you a zone block team? Are you a man block? What type of team are you in? Does he fit? You got to know that. So the fit is so important, and I think the coaching fit has a tremendous amount to do with the success of players in the league.
No doubt. We have the pleasure of bringing in Chris Landry from Landry Football Podcast. You can check him out, Radio Influence and iTunes as well. You know, you brought up some things that hit, you know, so close to home for me. I had a certain style of playing, and I would say my style was more aggressive than others. You know, being my stature and not that 6'7" guy, I had to be a little bit more aggressive. But when you talked about, you know, does he fit, my last year when I was in Denver, when Alex Gibbs was my offensive line coach, and I think Alex Gibbs, along with Rod Marinelli, are probably the best position coaches that I've ever seen. I'm just going to let you know, I couldn't do what he wanted me to do. Whatever it is he wanted me to do in that zone blocking scheme, I couldn't do it. And even to this day, I don't know what I was doing wrong, but I wasn't suited for that style. I thought I can really configure to any style until I got to Denver and I realized that wasn't for me.
Yeah, and that is an important part of it. And sometimes it's not reflective of, hey, the player, and people will say things, well, that was a bad signing or that was a bad pick. Well, maybe it was, but to be honest with you, good player, good coach, and maybe there's not that fit. And people ask me, well, how does that happen? And I say, it's no different than any part of society. How many people you know that, you know, a good man, good wife, you know, good woman, they get married, and for whatever reason, it didn't work out. I mean, I don't know, what's the divorce rate in this country? It's very high. Why is that? I don't know. I mean, I don't have that answer philosophically, and I think oftentimes when you make these decisions, that's why I think you have to make them as an organization, and I don't know why some of these things don't fit, but they don't, and sometimes you have to move on for the betterment of the player and of the team. It, for whatever reason, it just doesn't fit. I always wanted, from a coaching standpoint, to have some flexibility in our style and our scheme so that we never say that a really good player can't fit. We've got to find something that it can do well. And if a really good player can't fit, then maybe our system is a little too stringent, one. But two, you know, if you don't want to – you want to have a philosophy and an idea, because if you don't, well, then all of a sudden it's hodgepodge, and you know, you're running this one day and that the next day, and you're never good at anything. Well, try to be a master of something, and don't be, a jack of all trades. I think you want to have the ability to be really good and functional in your scheme, and I think finding that fit is very, very challenging, and no more so is that the case than on the offensive line, because I think that unit is more one. I mean, they got – think about it. It's the unit. Secondary's got more people now today with all the sub packages. But, you know, you got five guys there, and they have to act basically as one. And that's tough to do, and that's really tough to do. And finding something that just doesn't fit, it may not be the weak link, but it may be something that just doesn't fit. And all of a sudden, that chain just becomes a little loose, and it's the difference between success or lack thereof.
Now, I always consider myself kind of a student of the game, and, you know, people think there's a lot of guys just banging into each other, and there's a little bit of that, but the X's and O's and the chess matches going on out there, I don't think anybody will ever realize unless you actually played the game. Now, I had Ray Perkins as a coach, Richard Williamson, Sam Weitz, then I went to Tony Dungy, then I had Ray Rhodes, and John Gruden was our offensive coordinator. You know, I had a bunch of the coaches that were under Tony Dungy. After that, I went to Denver very briefly, but the best football mind that I was ever around in my whole life was Bill Parcells, because when football people talk, I listen. And I think he knew a lot about every single aspect of the game of football. I mean, the psychology, the whole nine yards, special teams, kicking, offensive line, D-line, he knew it all. Now, out of all your years, who had the best football mind? Who's the best football mind you've ever been around?
Well, you mentioned one, and I know Bill Parcells very well. He's there. Bill Walsh would be in that group. But Bill Belichick is the best I've ever been around. I've been around him longer and more than I was with Parcells. And as you know, a lot of what Belichick learned was from Parcells. And I always thought that Parcells was the absolute best I've ever been around at knowing a player and knowing what that player needed, what buttons you need to push with a player. And he did that with coaches too, Ian.
Yeah, he did.
He would have cases where he'd come out. Sean Payton tells me the story one time. He's coaching with him for Dallas, and he says, by the way, I'm going to be all over you today. I am going to dog cuss you, and Sean looks at him and says, your guys are not responding. So, you know what? I'm going to make you the guinea pig, and I'm going to get after you so bad that your players are going to feel bad for you. And he'd do stuff like that that, you know, I haven't really been. Now, I've seen Belichick just get after coaches and everyone got after me at times. So I think those are the best. Belichick's the best I've seen at situational football, at taking what a player can do, and most guys look and say, yeah, but this guy can't do that. Bill wants to know what a guy can do, and he builds around what a guy can do, and he does that with a game plan each week. He can morph his style to fit, to counteract what you do and take away what you do best. So now you're kind of going with your offhand, and you're having to try to find a way to be successful. He's the best at it. So when I sit there and say, man, I got this really good undersized nose tackle out of Arizona that's a playing fool that I know can make it in the league, and everybody says, where are you going to play him? He saw that Teddy Bruschi could be a good player, and he saw him as a guy that can be a linebacker, and he taught him one thing that first year, and then because he was smart and he worked, you know, he taught him a second thing and a third, and you know, the rest is history. And that's just one example of guys that he saw things in, or when you bring things to him, you know, he just didn't shut out. Well, Ian, no such thing as perfect players. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're Elway or Andrew Luck. Nobody's perfect. Just some have more strengths than others, but in a world of situational football, I think he does the best job because the bottom end of his roster has guys that maybe he's got guys that's starting that corner in the Super Bowl that were, you know, the dime back in you know, the first game of the year, and you're thinking that guy can't play, but by the end of the year he teaches them another thing and another and another, and he's a starting corner of the Super Bowl and playing well. He's the best I've ever seen at doing that. I didn't work as much with Bill Walsh, but he had a unique feeling. He felt like if a player did something, like if he did something well, that you could get him to do it on a consistent basis, and it was your job to get him to do it on an every down basis. But I would say those guys jump out at me at the most. Nick Saban, certainly, I work with on Belichick's staff, is another one, and obviously he's had a tremendous career. I tell you who else was good on the offensive line that I think is phenomenal, and this Kurt Ferentz, who happens to be the head coach at Iowa.
No doubt. Now, I actually was exposed to Bill Parcells at the story you just told about, you know, knowing what buttons to push. I've never seen somebody get the most out of their athletes. I always said when I was there at training camp, when I was at my lowest point, and I'm like, I don't want to do this no more. He walked by me. He goes, Beckles, I'm watching you. He goes, you can play. He goes, they had just drafted Randy Thomas, who ended up starting for quite a few years. He was a really good football player. And he goes, Beckles, I know you can play. This young kid's pretty darn good, so he's going to be in there, but I might want to try you at left guard. So at that time when I was at my lowest, he knew what to say. When I was at my highest and I'm like, I got this down, he would say, it's too bad you're not in shape, Beckles. You can play, but you're not in shape. So we kind of always bring you down to his level. I saw him, he said to the special teams coach, who was number 47, I think it was. And he said, Scott Frost, coach. He said, isn't Scott Frost a special teams player? He said, yes. He goes, then why is Scott Frost running 75%? He says, you tell Scott Frost, if I ever see him doing that again, I'm going to cut him in front of everybody on film. And Scott's right next to him. Okay, the next time we watch film, you've never seen Scott Frost run faster, and that's what he had the ability to do. He had an ability to take a kid who did one thing well or had a little dog in him, and he was able to bring it out. He also understood that you bring in football players. When I was with the Jets, I believe that was in 99, I think it was. If you looked around that locker room, it was full of people that played in the league at a high level for 10 years. I'm talking about Keyshawn Johnson, Vinny right. Testaverde, Kevin Mawai. Then you had Jumbo Elliott. You had Steve Atwater. You had Mo Lewis. I mean, I could go down the roster, and they're all recognizable people. When are some of these other coaches going to realize, bring in people who you know can play instead of bringing in these snotty-nosed rookies who are going to really stink for a year and a half?
Well, I think having that good blend, and, you know, Bill was always famous for that, bringing in his guys. They set the tone. You know, I think that it is more important than ever today to have tone setters in your locker room because you're around them. But as you know, with the limited time in the OTAs, if you don't have self-starters, if you don't have guys policing the locker room, getting the most out of them, it goes back to what I'm saying. You're in trouble. That's why it's all the more important to have guys that are, you know, that understand that they've got two ears and one mouth and use them accordingly and to listen and learn and do the things that you're supposed to do and are willing to follow leaders and listen to not only coaches but veterans on the team that know how to do it and that are successful. I think it's important to do that. And I think that's a big reason why he's been able to turn things around. He did that, and the other thing he said, and I think is always true, and you kind of touched on it, he believes, and if you study this, the quickest way to turn your team around from being bad to good is become good on special teams. Be really good on special teams. You can improve your team dramatically. And if you do that, because a lot of the concepts of what you do on special teams, you're getting good players and you're improving some of the defensive personnel. You're improving your athleticism, and it makes you a lot better. The special teams helps you field position wise on offense and defense. But I think bringing in guys is important. I think a lot of times, of course, some coaches, Ian, get criticized for bringing in too many of their own guys. I think people bring in their own guys, but are they bringing in the right guys? See, Bill brought in guys that he knew that would work hard and do things. I notice coaches sometimes that bring in guys that are easy to coach, meaning they already know my system, so I don't have to coach as hard. I hate to put it that way, but it comes out that's what happens. Well, sometimes those guys, they know your system, but maybe they're not the best leaders. Maybe they're not the hardest workers. Maybe they're just hanging on. So you got to bring in the right guys that if they know your system, that's great. But they also know what it's going to take in terms of effort and commitment. And if you bring in those type of guys, that can be the difference in kind of setting the tone of where your direction of your team is going.
No doubt. And like I said, when I'm looking at that locker room, and you say policing the locker room, I'm going to say this. A locker room polices itself. And I don't. Maybe not everybody's going to understand what I mean. But if you're in a locker room with, we'll give you, for instance, the Buccaneers back in the day when Rod Marinelli was a defensive line coach. If you're out there, you're not practicing hard, it's going to police itself because you're going to stand out. If you're in that Jets locker room and you don't know what's going on, you're going to stand out because everybody else in there knows what they're doing or else they wouldn't have lasted in the league for 10 years. So it's not one of those things where you need an athlete or a leader to grab somebody. I think people think that happens. A locker room completely polices itself when you look across the way and there's Curtis Martin getting extra work in. Or you're looking over here and you have some guy that's got Aaron Glenn getting extra work after practice. That's something that just happens, and you can't stay around a long time without having that love and that passion for the game.
Well, that's right, but that's what I mean by you have to have those guys. Not to come in and scream and holler and point things out, but by action do things. And maybe somebody, you know, like Parcells did with you, maybe somebody that puts an arm around you when you need it, or, you know, maybe say, hey, dude, you know, you need to pick it up. But by actions, like you said, you will stand out. Well, guess what? Sometimes not every locker room is like that. I mean, I wonder a little bit. I wonder about some guys that are talented, but they tend to do their own thing. If that's your leader, then what are the other guys are going to do? Because just as you said, the locker room polices itself. Well, it does. And when a player and players do things the right way and you're not, you get exposed. But now all of a sudden when your top guys don't do things and they're not spending time after practice and they're not doing those little things, well, what are the young guys are going to do? You don't know. I mean, just another example of like Parcells. I know when he got Bledsoe, Bledsoe was a guy that came in every morning. He studied film. He did everything he was asked to do. He did it, and he did, you know, listen, well, Parcells called him in and he said, tell me about how's it going. He said, well, you know, what time do you get in? You know, he says, well, I get in at, 7 o'clock and look at film. And, you know, that's what I do. He says, well, here's what you're going to do from now on. So from now on, you're going to get in at 6:15. And what you're going to do is you're going to bring the donuts for the offense. He says, and you're going to look at the film before the offense meets. So that when you're looking at film together as an offense, you've already seen it. You can point things out. And then now you're, because he's a young guy, now those veterans start to believe, hey, this guy. Well, Drew was, I mean, he was willing to do it, but, you know, he never really thought of doing that. But somebody put it in his head, hey, come in. Well, boy, from then on, he was in there at, I think, 6 o'clock, you know. So I think things like that are really important. I agree with you. I wonder a little bit about, let's say somebody like Ndamukong Suh, talented guy. Guy, he graded out well last year as a player, but, boy, he freelances a lot. He does his own thing. Now, does he go in Los Angeles? Does he do his own thing? Does he kind of, you know, blend in with Aaron Donald? Does he? I mean, exactly how that's going to work, I'm sitting here telling you, I don't know. Time will tell. Because in the past, he's been the leader, and he hadn't been much of a leader. You know, people look at him and say, well, he does that. You know, but when your best player are your hardest workers, that's when you got it. That's when you got what you're saying. That's when everybody has to conform. You don't think in New England right now that it is, quite frankly, easy for Bill Belichick to coach that team when you got Tom Brady, that's the hardest working guy? Who else is going to take a second off, much less a day off, if you got your best player that's the hardest worker?
That's well said. And you know, while we're talking about defensive tackles, I mean, I want to get your assessment of Gerald McCoy as a football player.
I think Joe McCoy is an outstanding football player. I think he's an elite player. I think he's a guy that plays hard. I think he's, I think the play around him needs to get better. I think that he does a good job fighting through teams when he sees a lot of that. I think his use of hands is outstanding. I think he plays with good leverage, and I think he finishes well. I have graded him very, very highly the past couple of years in my pro personnel work. I think he's still one of the better defensive tackles in the league. And that's saying a lot, because there are a lot of good, high-graded defensive tackles. Aaron Donald, Fletcher Cox, Geno Atkins, Kawan Short. Seuss played well, although he freelances. Buckner's starting to play well against the run. Snacks Harrison is great. Gerald McCoy's in that group, in my opinion.
Now, I'm going to give you my opinion, okay? Because your opinion seems to be the opinion of a lot of people. And I tend to disagree with some, and I have for quite a while. When I watched Gerald McCoy as a football player, and this is not a personal thing. This is from what I've, you know, encountered in the past from great football players. Some of the things you said are 100% true. He does play with great hands. He does play with great leverage. He does play very hard. He's very explosive. This is my problem. He never makes plays. That's a problem. Because when you ran the ball next to greatness, greatness made the tackle. And if you go back and watch the film, it's more the plays that he doesn't make than the plays that he does make. The plays that he doesn't make when he's supposed to spike in the A gap and gets pushed all the way to the other tackle box, and then they wonder why everybody's running the ball up the middle on us all day long. I find he freelances too much for me, and I find that he's not very selfless. If you look back to the Buccaneers when the Buccaneers were great, Warren Sapp was a selfless football player. Although he was out there to get statistics, he at times gave himself up for other people to make plays. I keep on hearing everybody needs to put more talent around him for him to get better, but when J.J. Watt was great, who did he need? When John Randall was great, you don't need anybody else when you're great. And he still, to me, hasn't made anybody around him better. And then you got to hear how much he's a leader. And like Ndamukong Suh, I have to start asking, what have you led? What have you led to this point? It's been many, many years in the league now where he hasn't led anything successful. He hasn't had many statistics. His defense never been ranked high. And he doesn't get a lot of tackles. That's me. Okay, I'm not trying to change anybody's opinion of the guy, but watch the plays he doesn't make more so than watch the plays he does make for me.
Well, yeah, and I don't, you know, to put the term great and put him, I don't think he's Warren Sapp. I don't think many people are. I don't think he's at that level. I don't think he's kind of one of those all-time difference makers. Now, I will say that to me, I would say that when you have good play around them, that makes the ability to make more plays. I mean, I think, like, for example, Sapp made a lot of plays that were just him, but there's a lot of other guys that had success too because of Sapp, and then there are opportunities that Sapp had because you're trying to decide where you want to go and how you want to adjust your protection schemes. Right now, pretty much, I know coordinators say McCoy's the guy we've got to worry about, and I think better play around him will help him. But it's a fair point. If you're grading him on a standard of one of the all-time greats, no, I can't go there. In the game today, I still think he's pretty good, and I always look at it too. What's the alternative? If I'm looking at what I call blue-grade players, Bucks don't have enough of those guys, and I think he's one of them. But, you know, heck, I may be a little higher on him than I should.
Oh, it's all day. If everybody have an opinion, that's all good. Now, let's talk about evaluating out of college. This is something that drives me nuts. Okay, I love to watch the combine. Like, I'll watch it all day long. I'll watch receivers. I don't care. I'll watch the 40s. I enjoy it. I went through it. I don't like to watch the draft itself, but the combine to me is very enjoyable. What drives me nuts is when I see, well, Mel Kiper drives me nuts, period. But when I see somebody like Mel Kiper all of a sudden get real high on somebody because they ran a great 40. Now, in your, you know, experience, how do you weigh the importance of evaluating an athlete when you compare film to combine? I mean, how important is film compared to the combine workout?
Well, first of all, with all due respect to the Mels and Mayocks and those guys are not scouts. They're on TV and they're information gatherers. I did a podcast about it back last week. They talk to people, they get information, and, you know, so they're whoever they talk to last is, you know, who they're going to like, and they're not evaluators themselves. To answer your question, 90%. I call it the 90% rule. When I look at the combine and the workouts, and the reason why, as you know, I ran the combine, and the reason why we started the combine, and I was involved in starting it in early 80s, it was for medical physicals. When we did the workouts, all the workouts do, Ian, is confirm what a guy does on film. So if a guy plays with strength, he'll test well with strength. If he plays with clickness, it's the 10% of the time when the film doesn't match the workout that I have to go back and do more work. Why doesn't it match? And the assumption, you can't make the assumption, well, the guy's not a player. You know, the guy can't play. He's not that good. He's just a workout guy. Well, you better not make that assumption. You better make sure. You know what they say about assumption. You assume you may look like the first three letters of it. You know, if you assume what Alvin Kamara, you know, he didn't play at Tennessee. He was a backup. If he's a backup at Tennessee, how the heck can he play in the league? Except, you know, he's an all-pro running back this year. You know, you could well, Jason Pierre-Paul, guy that didn't have really good film at South Florida. Well, he didn't have a lot of football background. Didn't know what he was doing. I mean, so you have to look at that. You have to, but a really good athlete. Now, he slept a little bit, and he's had a good career, and hopefully we'll have some more. I think that what happens is, I know when I was running the combine, and I'm not saying it was better because the world has changed, but it was just all football people. It wasn't on TV, and it wasn't out of hand. What's happening now, Ian, is you know it as well as I do. It's on TV. So it's a big event. So what do you do in the TV world of hype? Oh, let me tell you, I got a new mock draft. Come in and see it. It's this. It's going to change. This guy's moving up. This guy's moving down. Ain't nobody moving up or down.
Nope.
Teams are getting in the draft meetings right now, and they're setting up the board. So how the heck can you move up or down a board that hadn't been set yet? But it creates a narrative. Hey, this is exciting. Come watch the combine. You got to watch it for 3 days because this is going to change your – this guy's going to move up and down. It's hype. It's talk. It's not real. It's about as important as a touchdown dance is to actually scoring a touchdown. You follow me? It's the hype part of it. So, listen, the workouts are important because it helps to determine – because people say, well, you know, the film is the only thing that matters. Why do you even work them out? No. The workouts are important. It just needs to be put in perspective because, look, if you're looking at film, and I always use this exaggerated example. If you got a receiver who runs 4.7 and a corner that runs 4.75, if you watch film, that receiver is going to look fast. But the reality is neither one of them are fast enough to play in the league because you're not going to be able to get open and you're not going to be able to cover. Well, the testing of the times helped to bring in a standard of what we look for at each position. But a player has to play that way. If he doesn't play that way, you're going to have a hard time. You make mistakes sometimes just on film. I mean, everybody says you make mistakes on workout guys. You do. But you also make mistakes on guys that have great film. Peter Warrick was a great receiver at Florida State. And one of the things I wondered was, you know, how fast is he? And when we timed him and we worked him out, he didn't appear all that fast. Well, you remember, Ian, he was drafted very, very high. It's like fourth overall, I believe. But he didn't have really good workout, and he didn't make it. Why? He couldn't get open. He wasn't fast enough. So the workouts are important, but it's about 10%. And it only is to augment what you see on film, and it only is to kind of separate. And I think it's important for a smaller college guy. You know, that's why the all-star games, I think, are more important for the smaller college guy because they play against a tougher level of competition. You play in the Big Ten and you're going up against really good players. You're going up against a lot of players that are also going to be in the draft. Whereas a guy that comes from, you know, a small school, you know, maybe small school in Canada or somewhere, you know, that in college and in high school in Canada, the ball's not the same. So now you're having to look, boy, this is a huge jump in competition. So you want to see what he can do in the all-star game, and you want to see what he can do in the workouts. And again, good workouts don't mean good football player, but if he's got the tangibles and he also, you do the work and you feel like he's got the intangibles, in time can be developed into a really good player. But you gotta evaluate the whole puzzle. And I think a lot of it is people buy into the hype machine. And I don't pay attention to any of that. And, you know, people can believe what they want, but the only thing people care about is mock drafts and this and that and moving up and down. The only thing that's important, we never had one mock draft, and I still do work and still involved in some scouting meetings with teams. Nobody ever conducts a mock draft. The only thing you're concerned about, if you're picking seventh, who's likely going to be there? And what do we do if we want to move up? who would we move up for? What would it cost us? What would be willing to do if we wanted to move down? Same thing. What could we get? And then if we stay there, who we're going to take? And who's likely? Let's go through every scenario of who's going to be there. You know, that's what you do. You're not worried necessarily about, you know, somebody's mock draft, and certainly mock drafts do not indicate who the best players are. Last year, you know, on the website, we talked about how Alvin Kamara we thought was a first-round talent. Well, it doesn't matter that he's a third-round pick. You know, that's a projection, which doesn't mean anything. The guy, I think, has proven to be a first-round talent thus far. Maybe long-term, maybe it won't be. But I think that's what's important. It's all rooted in proper evaluation. If you don't evaluate correctly, you don't have a good draft board set up, you're going to make mistakes. And a lot of times they do that. Ian, it's no different than having a good game plan to play on Sunday. If you have a bad game plan, or if you have a game plan and you don't adjust, you're dead.
Nope.
And the same thing applies when you're preparing for the draft. The draft is game day. But everything you do leading up to it all year round is the preparation for game day, and you have to prepare for every situation. You don't sit down on third and short and decide on the goal line, what will we do? Any idea? You already know by your preparation what you think is going to be the most effective going into the game. And then based upon how well you've been able to block up front, you determine, hey, this is our best play in third and short. This is what we're going to do. It's all based upon how you've studied it. The same thing applies to the draft. It's too much hyped that is not realistic, but the guys hyping it have never been inside a draft room, so they don't know.
Sure. You know, when you talk about, you know, people think that football is like Madden, where you could just pick a play, you know, when they'll say, I've heard fans say, well, why did we run the ball up the middle with Allstott? Everybody knows we're going to run up the middle with Allstott. Well, we have one running back, and there's only a few things you can do on short yardage. Sometimes the defense is going to make plays. It's not quite as easy as you guys think it is. And, you know, when you go back to the draft, and I hate mock drafts. Like, I don't want to. Who cares? I have no idea who cares about a mock draft. Now, this is another thing that's crazy. When you're hearing, oh, there's rumors coming out of so-and-so that they're going to pick this player. No, because if a rumor came out that anybody was giving away who you were going to try to pick, whoever let it out is going to be fired immediately.
That's correct.
Like, right,
that's correct.
Right away. You cannot leak anything, and there's not that many people that know much about it anyways. Now, the Buccaneers have the 7th pick in the draft. Now, I'm going to give you a couple names and just briefly let me know what you know about these kids. Minkah Fitzpatrick.
Minkah Fitzpatrick is the most versatile secondary player seen in the league for some time. His ability as a player is unique in that I think he's probably a little bit better than Jalen Ramsey. He's a true difference maker, team leader. He's instinctive. He can line up anywhere in the secondary. He can tackle. He can cover. He can match up against elite receivers. I see him best in the slot, where he can be a huge factor as a blitzer as well as a cover guy. And against the run, he can carry a big slot, a tight end, a back down the field. And his best quality is his instincts. You know what he does worst is play the ball with his back towards the play. You know what I mean? He could play deep, but you know that's not the best thing that he does. He's got the size and strength to match up versus size receivers, yet he's quick enough to deal with the two-way, you know, quicker slot guys. So he sorts through trash well against the run. He's impeccable feel as a blitzer. I think he's, you know, it's where you want to play him. I think he could play both safety spots, but I think see him as more of an inside defender guy that can cover, which, as you know, is a starting position in the league.
Sure. Now, you were talking about not being able to play all that well with your back to the ball. I mean, we had a player here that's going to be was a borderline Hall of Famer, hasn't got in. John Lynch, that wasn't his strength either. Like, mm-hmm. he tried to keep the ball in front of him, so you could still be very, very effective and not be great at, you know, having your back to the ball.
And you would agree, and I love John, but you wouldn't want to put John covering an outside receiver,
nope.
a fast receiver.
Nope.
Minkah Fitzpatrick could do it.
Okay.
And not hurt you at all. So he's, listen, I'm not going to put him in John Lynch's category, but instinctively, this kid's really good. but he's got some athleticism and some versatility. I think he's an elite player. Listen, he's one of the top four players in the draft in my mind.
What about Quentin Nelson, the center from Notre Dame? I got a chance to see some of his highlights, and I can't evaluate. If I took my five best blocks in college, I'd have been the first pick in the draft.
So, that's,
I mean,
right.
People want to evaluate somebody over 10 plays. You know, I can't do that. I haven't got a chance to sit down and watch his game. What's Quentin Nelson all about from Notre Dame?
Well, you'd love him if you get a chance. You'd love his play. First of all, he's naturally big, strong, powerful, unusual strength. Just plays with those heavy hands. You know what I mean? He can really throw people around. Underrated pass protector. Love his work habits. Probably the best thing he does. Team leader. Shows good balance and quickness when he goes on to the second level. Adjusts well on pulls. Love his hand quickness. His punch and pass protection is really violent. Really good anchor strength. I think his mirror and recover ability are good. I think he has a chance to be a great player because not only does he have the natural skills, but he has that toughness. He has that love for the game that we've talked about throughout this podcast. I think he's just outstanding. To me, he's a plug-and-play offensive guard that I don't want to, you know, before a guy does it, I have a hard time, you know, saying it, but if I was going to sit there and tell you, I would say that I would be shocked if this guy's not a perennial Pro Bowler. In 5 years, I'd be shocked if he's not the best guard in the league or right up there. I mean, he has just got those natural abilities. If you look at the top guards in the league right now, I think he compares very favorably to the top guys. DeCastro, Martin, I think he's got that ability, not immediately, but I think within a couple of years he could be that. So I'm as high on him as you can be, and some people will argue the value of the guard, and I think every position's important. But I can say this, he may be the safest pick in the draft. I don't see any scenario where he's not good.
Yeah, what's crazy is that the average fan, you know, they look at wide receivers and they look at quarterbacks and running backs and they're sexy picks. Man, if you give me a good offensive line, I mean, the Dallas Cowboys are probably the best example of, you know, really building their whole team around their offensive line, and now you can really put anybody back there and they can rush for 1,500 yards. So when you look at a Quentin Nelson, who I would love to get picked, but everybody here would like a Saquon Barkley. I don't know if he's going to be there at the seventh pick. For myself, I don't want to pick a number seven as a running back. I don't care how good you look. I don't care. Listen, I know the game of football. He's a special running back, no doubt. But there's only one problem I have. They don't really make special running backs anymore. They don't exist anymore. He looks like a kid that runs really hard, and in a year and a half from now, he's going to be a hamstring or a concussion away from his career going downhill. What's your opinion?
Well, first of all, on the first part, I don't see Nelson or Barkley being there for the Bucs. I think Barkley will long be gone, and I would be surprised if Nelson last passed the Colts at six, because I think he's an elite player, and I think when the Colts made that move from three to six, that's basically who they wanted anyway. They're not in the quarterback business, so they get a boatload of picks and still get the guy that they want. So, I mean, I think both are gone. I'll say this on running backs. I think you can get good running backs throughout the draft. I think elite touchdown-making running backs, special, the Todd Gurley's, Zeke Elliott. I mean, guys like that are special. I think they're difference makers that can score touchdowns, change the game. I think, like, for example, with Dallas, behind that offensive line, Zeke, that's a you got a pretty good team right there, mm-hmm. And you pretty much kind of got to screw it up around them. So I guess I value the great running back, but you say there's not any great ones. I still think they're few and far between, and they don't have them every year. I thought Gurley was one. I think Barkley. To me, I look at Barkley as a bigger. The kid that New Orleans drafted, I was just talking about, that had the great year.
I know you're talking
Alvin
about
Kamara, Alvin Kamara. He's 20 pounds heavier than Alvin Kamara. Runs with a little bit more power and more athleticism. Now, to me, that's a difference maker. Now, New Orleans, great quarterback, great play caller. You give me a guy that to me can, and this guy can line up at receiver and make plays for you. He is an elite receiver. He's one of the best route runners that I've seen coming out of college in the past 5 or 6 years. Receivers and running backs, he's elite in that area. So I think he's a playmaker, but, you know, again, where does he go? How well do they utilize him? You know, that we talked about that all hour. It's just been it's a common theme in how well you know, say the Giants take him. I think he can have an impact. They still need to improve that offensive line in New York, and they got some other areas. But I think he's an impact player. I think Nelson, in fact, the top two players in this draft for me are Barkley and Nelson in that order.
Now, I hear people say pro ready. I don't know exactly what pro ready means. Uh-huh. Who in your mind is the most pro ready kid in the draft this year?
I would say Barkley and Nelson. I mean, I think Nelson could come in and I think he could start as a guard, which, as you know, right away. And I know a lot of guys do start. When I say start and be effective as a guard right away, I think Barkley can do the same. I would say those two guys are the most pro ready. Then I would probably say a guy like Fitzpatrick that we talked about would be the next.
Wonderful. Well, Chris, our hour is up, brother. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your knowledge. If anybody wants to check Chris Landry out, it's Landry Football Podcast. It comes out on Tuesday and Thursday. I only have enough knowledge to do once a week. So, maybe when I grow up, I can do two a week. I do another one where I talk about pop culture and politics, so I get to talk about Donald Trump. That's fun.
That's good. That'll keep you busy. I'm surprised that doesn't have you do five a day.
Yeah, well, it could almost be five a day, no doubt. Well, Chris, I appreciate your time, brother. Let's do this again sometime, all right?
I appreciate it. It's a pleasure and an honor being on with you. Thank you for having me. God bless.
Good stuff. Everybody, this has been In the Trenches. I want to thank Chris Landry again. You can check him out at Radio Influence and iTunes Landry Football Podcast. And if you guys want to get in contact with me, Ian Beckles at RadioInfluence.com, if you want to email me. I appreciate you guys listening in. Everybody have a wonderful week. Peace out.
You have been in the trenches with Ian Beckles on Radio Influence.
This is a Crush Performance Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
You go back to 2010 when the team was sold. These guys were bottom dwellers and there was no hope. I don't think if you went back to 2008, 2009 with the Astros, I don't think you could see the light of day in terms of being competitive at the top of the league, not just because of their payroll, but because of the organization from top to bottom was in such a mess. New owners come in, they turn it around, get in some new leadership, they turn this ship around. It's like one of those big tankers turning. It's a slow process, but they did it. This is an absolute orchestrated assault on success in the sport, and they've done it. And not only that, they did it on their timeline. Now, was the changing of the leagues part of the original plan? I'm not so sure. I know it was in the talk, but I think that played a role, and how they responded to that change was absolutely fantastic. They spent money and got players at the right time. The Astros are going to be successful for years and years to come because of what they've done. And I want everybody to understand that behind the scenes, this was absolutely orchestrated. There's no fluke at all involved here.
Crush Performance with the Crusher, Jeff Crichel, can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.